breaths. I'm only thinking, Gromare, as how himself here, Germaine nodded at Pardlow, might be missed. Had I maybe best carry a message to someone, so as they aren't sending out soldiers after him? The chairman will talk, will he not?
Ah, that was a thought, all right. General Clinton, for one, certainly knew that Pardlow was in my company when last seen. I had no idea with whom Pardlow might be travelling, or whether he was in command of his regiment. If he was, people would be looking for him right now. An officer couldn't be gone from his place for long without someone noticing.
And Germaine, an observant lad, if ever there was one, was right about the chairmen. Their numbers meant they were registered with the Central Chairmen's Agency in Philadelphia. It would be the work of a moment for the general staff to locate numbers 39 and 40 and find out where they delivered the Duke of Pardlow. Jenny, who'd been tending the array of teacups, stepped in now with the next and knelt by Pardlow, nodding to me that she would see to his breathing while I talked to Germaine. He told the chairman to bring me to the King's Arms, I said to Germaine, taking him out onto the porch where we could confer unheard. And I met him at General Clinton's office in the...
I ken where it is, Gromare.
I dare say you do. Have you something in mind?
Well, I'm thinking.
He glanced into the house, then back at me, eyes narrowed in thought.
How long do you mean to keep him prisoner, Gromare?
So my motives hadn't escaped Germaine. I wasn't surprised. He undoubtedly had heard all about the day's excitements from Mrs. Fig, and knowing as he did who Jamie was, had probably deduced even more. I wondered if he'd seen William. If so, he likely knew everything. If he didn't, though, there was no need to reveal that little complication until it was necessary.
"Until your grandfather comes back," I said, "or possibly Lord John," I added as an afterthought.
I hoped with all my being that Jamie would come back shortly, but it might be that he would find it necessary to stay outside the city and send John in to bring me news. "The minute I let the Duke go, he'll be turning the city upside down in search of his brother, always assuming for the sake of argument that he doesn't drop dead in the process." And the very last thing I wanted was to instigate a dragnet in which Jamie might be snared.
Germaine rubbed his chin thoughtfully, a peculiar gesture in a child too young for whiskers, but his father to the life, and I smiled.
"That's maybe not too long," he said. "Grandpère will come back directly. He was wild to see you last night."
He grinned at me, then looked through the open doorway, pursing his lips.
"As to himself, you canna hide where he is," he said. "But if you were to send a note to the general, and maybe another to the King's Arms, seeing as how his Grace was staying with Lord John, they wouldna start searching for him right away. And even if someone was to come here later and inquire, I suppose you might give him a wee dram that would keep him quiet, so you could tell them he was gone. Or maybe lock him in a closet, tied up with a gag, if it should be he's got his voice back by then," he added.
Germaine was a very logical, thorough-minded sort of person. He got it from Massali.
"Excellent thought," I said, forbearing to comment on the relative merits of the options for keeping Pardlow incommunicado. "Let me do that now." Pausing for a quick look at Pardlow, who was doing better, though still wheezing strongly, I whipped upstairs and flipped open John's writing desk. It was the work of a moment to mix the ink powder and write the notes. I hesitated briefly over the signature, but then caught sight of John's signet on the dressing table. He hadn't had time to put it on. The thought gave me a slight pang. In the overwhelming joy of seeing Jamie alive, and then the shock of William's advent, Jamie's taking John hostage, and the violence of William's exit. Dear Lord, where was William now? I had pushed John to the back of my mind.
Still, I told myself, he was quite safe. Jamie wouldn't let any harm come to him.
and directly he came back into Philadelphia... The chiming of the carriage clock on the mantelpiece interrupted me, and I glanced at it. 4 o'clock. Time flies when you're having fun, I murmured to myself, and scribbling a reasonable facsimile of John's signature, I lit the candle from the embers in the hearth, dripped wax on the folded notes, and stamped them with a smiling half-moon ring. Maybe John would be back before the notes were even delivered, and Jamie, surely, would be with me as soon as darkness made it safe. Chapter 9. A Tide in the Affairs of Men. Jamie wasn't alone on the road. He'd been dimly aware of horses passing by, heard the distant talk of men on foot. But now that he'd come out of his red haze, he was startled to see how many there were. He saw what was plainly a militia company, not marching, but on the move as a body, knots and clumps of men, solitary riders, and a few wagons coming from the city, piled with goods, women and children afoot beside them. He'd seen a few folk leaving Philadelphia when he'd come in the day before. God, was it only yesterday? And thought to ask Fergus about it, but in the excitement of arrival and the later complications, had quite forgotten. His sense of disturbance increased, and he kicked up his horse to a faster pace. It was no more than 10 miles to the city. He'd be there long before nightfall. Maybe just as well if it's dark, he thought grimly. Easier to have things out with Claire alone and undisturbed. And whether the having out led to beating or bed, he wanted no interference. The thought was like the striking of one of Brianna's matches. Just the word bed, and he was aflame with fresh rage. Ethan, he said aloud, and slammed his fist against the pommel. All the trouble to calm himself, and all to waste in an instant. God damn it! Damn him! Damn her! John Gray, damn everything! Mr. Fraser! He jerked as though shot in the back, and the horse slowed at once, snorting. Mr. Fraser, came the loud, wheezy voice again, and Daniel Morgan came trotting up alongside on a small, sturdy bay, grinning all over his big, scarred face. Knew that was you, knew it. Ain't no other rascal that size with that colour hair, and if there is one, I don't want to meet him. Colonel Morgan, he said, noting old Dan's unaccustomed uniform with the fresh insignia on the collar. On your way to a wedding? He did his best to smile, though the turmoil inside him was like the whirlpools off the rocks of Struma. What? All that, said Dan, trying to look sideways down his own neck. Pfft! Washington's a damn stickler for proper dress. The Continental Army's got more generals than they got private soldiers these days. An officer lives through more'n 2 battles, they make him some kind of general on the spot. Now getting any pay for it, that's a different kettle of fish.
He tipped back his hat and looked Jamie up and down.
Just come back from Scotland? Heard you went with Brigadier Fraser's body. Your kin, I suppose.
He shook his head regretfully.
Crying shame, fine soldier, good man. Aye, it was that. We buried him near his home at Balneen.
They continued together, old Dan asking questions and Jamie replying as briefly as good manners and his real affection for Morgan would allow. They hadn't met since Saratoga, where he'd served under Morgan as an officer of his rifle corps, and there was a good deal to say. Still, he was glad of the company, and even of the questions. They distracted him and kept his mind from catapulting him again into fruitless fury and confusion.
"I suppose we must part here," Jamie said after a bit.
They were approaching a crossroads, and Dan had slowed his pace a bit.
"I'm bound into the city myself." "What for?"
Morgan asked, rather surprised.
"I... to see my wife."
His voice wanted to tremble on the word wife, and he bit it off sharp.
Oh, yes? Could you maybe spare a quarter hour?
Dan was giving him a sort of calculating look that made Jamie instantly uneasy. But the sun was still high. He didn't want to enter Philadelphia before dark.
"Aye, maybe," he replied cautiously. "To do what?" "I'm on my way to see a friend. Want you to meet him. It's right close, won't take a moment. Come on."
Morgan veered right, waving at Jamie to follow, which, cussing himself for a fool, he did.
Number 17, Chestnut Street. I was sweating as freely as the Duke was by the time the spasm eased enough for him to breathe without the positive pressure exercise. I wasn't quite as tired as he was. He lay back in the chair, exhausted, eyes closed, drawing slow, shallow, but free breaths. But close. I felt lightheaded too. It's not possible to help someone breathe without doing a lot of it yourself. And I was hyperventilated.
"Here, a pure Kayla."
Jenny's voice spoke by my ear, and it was only when I opened my eyes in surprise that I realized they'd been closed. She put a small glass of brandy in my hand.
"There's nae whiskey in the house, but I expect this will help. Shall I give his grace a dram too?"
"Yes, you shall,"
the Duke said with great authority, though he didn't move a muscle or open his eyes.
"Thank you, madam."
"It won't hurt him," I said, drawing myself up and stretching my back.
"Or you either.
Sit down and have a drink."
"You too, Mrs. Fig."
Jenny and Mrs. Fig had worked nearly as hard as I had, fetching and grinding and brewing, bringing cool cloths to mop the sweat, spelling me now and then with the counting, and by combining their not inconsiderable force of will with mine, helping to keep him alive. Mrs. Fig had very fixed notions of what was proper, and these didn't include sitting down to share a dram with her employer, let alone a visiting duke, but even she was obliged to admit that the circumstances were unusual. Glass in hand, she perched primly on an ottoman near the parlour door, where she could deal with any potential invasions or domestic emergencies. No one spoke for some time, but there was a great sense of peace in the room. The hot, still air carried that sense of odd camaraderie that binds people who have passed through a trial together, if only temporarily. I gradually became aware that the air was carrying noises, too, from the street outside. Groups of people moving hurriedly, shouts from the next block, and a rumble of wagons, and a distant rattle of drums. Mrs. Fig was aware of it, too. I saw her head rise, the ribbons of her cap a-tremble with inquisitiveness.
"Baby Jesus have mercy,"
she said, setting down her empty glass with care.
"Something's coming."
Jenny looked startled and glanced at me, apprehensive.
"Coming?" she said. "What's coming?"
"The Continental Army, I expect," said Pardlow.
He let his head fall back, sighing.
"Dear God, what it is to draw breath."
His breath was still short, but not very much constrained. He raised his glass ceremoniously to me.
"Thank you, my dear. I was already in your debt for your kind services to my son, but..."
"What do you mean, the Continental Army?"
I interrupted. I set down my own glass, now empty. My heart rate had calmed after the exertions of the last hour, but now abruptly sped up again. Pardlow closed one eye and regarded me with the other.
"The Americans," he said mildly. "The rebels. What else would I mean?"
"And when you say coming," I said carefully.
"I didn't,"
he pointed out, then nodded at Mrs. Fig.
"She did. She's right, though. General Clinton's forces are withdrawing from Philadelphia. I dare say Washington is poised to rush in.
Jenny made a small sputtering noise, and Mrs. Fig said something really blasphemous in French, then clapped a broad, pink-palmed hand to her mouth.
"Oh," I said, doubtless sounding as blank as I felt.
I'd been so distracted during my meeting with Clinton earlier in the day that the logical consequences of a British withdrawal had not occurred to me at all. Mrs. Fig stood up.
"I'd best go and be burying the silver, then," she said in a matter-of-fact sort of way. "It'll be under the laburnum bush by the cookhouse, Lady John."
"Wait," I said, raising a hand. "I don't think we need do that just yet, Mrs. Fig. The army hasn't yet left the city. The Americans aren't precisely snapping at our heels. And we'll need a few forks with which to eat our supper."
She made a low rumbling noise in her throat, but seemed to see the sense in this. She nodded and began to collect the brandy glasses instead.
"What you be wanting for supper, then? I got a cold boiled ham, but I was thinking to make a chicken fricassee. William, liking that so much."
She cast a bleak look at the hallway where the bloody smudges on the wallpaper had now turned brown.
"You think he's coming back for his supper?"
William had an official billet somewhere in the town, but frequently spent the night at the house, particularly when Mrs. Fig was making chicken fricassee.
"God knows," I said. I hadn't had time to contemplate the William situation, what with everything else. Might he come back when he'd cooled down, determined to have things out with John? I'd seen a Fraser on the boil many times, and they didn't sulk, as a rule. They tended to take direct action at once. I eyed Jenny speculatively. She returned the look and casually leaned her elbow on the table, chin in hand, and tapped her fingers thoughtfully against her lips. I smiled privately at her.
"Where is my nephew?"
Hal asked, finally able to take note of something other than his next breath.
"For that matter, where is my brother?"
"I don't know," I told him, putting my own glass on Mrs. Fig's tray and scooping his up to add to it. I really wasn't lying about that, but I do expect he'll be back soon. I rubbed a hand over my face and smoothed my hair back as well as I could.
First things first, I had a patient to tend.
"I'm sure John wants to see you as much as you want to see him, but..."
"Oh, I doubt it," the Duke said.
His eyes travelled slowly over me, from bare feet to dishevelled hair, and the faint look of amusement on his face deepened.
"You must tell me how John happened to marry you, when there's time."
"A counsel of desperation," I said shortly. "But in the meantime, we must get you to bed. Mrs. Fig, is the back bedroom?"
"Thank you, Mrs. Fig,"
the Duke interrupted.
"I shan't be requiring..."
He was trying to struggle up out of the chair and hadn't enough breath to talk.
I walked up to him and gave him my best piercing head matron look.
"Harold," I said in measured tones, "I am not merely your sister-in-law."
The term gave me an odd frisson, but I ignored it.
"I am your physician. If you don't..."
"What?" I demanded. He was staring up at me with the most peculiar expression on his face, something between surprise and amusement. "You invited me to use your Christian name, didn't you?"
"I did," he admitted. "But I don't think anyone has actually called me Harold since I was 3 years old."
He did smile then, a charming smile, quite his own.
"The family call me Hal."
"Hal, then," I said, smiling back, but refusing to be distracted. "You're going to have a nice refreshing sponge bath, Hal, and then you're going to bed."
He laughed, though he cut it short as he began to wheeze. He coughed a little, fist balled under his ribs, and looked uneasy. But it stopped, and he cleared his throat and glanced up at me.
"You'd think I was 3 years old, sister-in-law. trying to send me to bed without my tea?
He pressed himself gingerly upright, getting his feet under him. I put a hand on his chest and pushed. He hadn't any strength in his legs and fell back into the chair, astonished and affronted. And afraid. He hadn't realized, or at least hadn't admitted, his own weakness. A severe attack usually left the victim completely drained, and often with the lungs still dangerously twitchy.
"You see," I said, tempering my tone with gentleness. "You've had attacks like this before, haven't you?"
"Well, yes,"
he said unwillingly. "But..."
"And how long were you in bed after the last one?" His lips compressed.
"A week, but the fool doctor..."
I put a hand on his shoulder and he stopped, as much because he'd temporarily run short of air as because of the touch.
"You cannot breathe yet on your own," I said, separating the words for emphasis.
"Listen to me, Hal. Look what's happened this afternoon, will you? You had a fairly severe attack in the street. Had that crowd on 4th Street decided to set upon us, you would have been quite helpless. Don't argue with me, Hal. I was there."
I narrowed my eyes at him. He did the same back at me, but didn't argue.
"Then the walk from the street to the door of the house, a distance of some 20 feet, threw you straight into a full-blown status asthmaticus. Have you heard that term before?"
"No,"
he muttered. "Well, now you have, and now you know what it is. And you were in bed for a week the last time. Was it as bad as this?" His lips were a thin line, and his eyes sparking. I imagine most people didn't speak to a duke, let alone the commander of his own regiment, like this. Be good for him, I thought.
"Bloody doctor. Said it was my heart."
His fist had uncurled, and the fingers were slowly rubbing his chest.
"Knew it wasn't that."
"I think you're probably right about that," I conceded. "Was this the same doctor who gave you the smelling salts? Complete quack, if so."
He laughed, a brief, breathless sound.
"Yes, he is."
He paused to breathe for a moment.
"Though in justice, he didn't give me salts. Got them myself. For fainting. Told you."
"So you did."
I sat down beside him and took hold of his wrist. He let me, watching curiously. His pulse was fine. It had slowed and was thumping along very steadily.
"How long have you been subject to fainting spells?" I asked, bending to look closely into his eyes.
"No sign of petechial hemorrhage.
No jaundice. Pupils the same size."
"A long time," he said,
and pulled his wrist abruptly away.
"I haven't time to chat about my health, madam. I..."
"Claire," I said, and put a restraining hand on his chest, smiling amiably at him.
"You're Hal?
I'm Claire."
"And you aren't going anywhere, Your Grace."
"Take your hand off me."
"I'm seriously tempted to do just that and let you fall on your face," I told him. "But wait until Mrs. Fig finishes brewing the tincture. I don't want you thrashing about on the floor, gasping like a landed fish, and no way of getting the hook out of your mouth."
I did, in fact, take my hand off his chest, though, and rising, I went out into the hall before he could find breath to say anything. Jenny had taken up a stand by the open doorway, looking up and down the street.
"What's going on out there?" I asked.
"Had dinner, Ken?" she said, not taking her eyes off a couple of rough-looking men who were lounging down the other side of the street.
"But I didn't like the feel of it a bit. Do you think he's right?"
"That the British Army is leaving?
Yes, they are.
And very likely half the Loyalists in the city with them."
I knew exactly what she meant by not liking the feel of things.
The air was hot and thick, buzzing with cicadas, and the leaves of the chestnut trees along the street hung limp as dish rags. But something was moving in the atmosphere. Excitement? Panic? Fear? All three, I thought.
Had I best go to the print shop, do you think? She asked, turning to me with a slight frown.
Would Marsali and the Waynes be safer if I fetched them here? I mean, if there was to be a riot or the like.
I shook my head.
I don't think so. They're well-known patriots. It's the loyalists who will be in danger if the British army is leaving. They won't have any protection. And the rebels may well do things to them. And a very unpleasant feeling snaked down my backbone like a cold, slimy finger. This is a loyalist household. Without even a door to shut and bolt, I might have added, but didn't. There was a loud thump from the parlour, as of a body hitting the floor. But Jenny didn't turn a hair, nor did I. We'd both had a lot of experience with stubborn men. I could hear him panting. If he started wheezing again, I'd go in.
"Will it put you in danger, then, to have him here?" she asked sotto voce, with a tilt of her head toward the parlour. "Maybe you'd best come to the print shop."
I grimaced, trying to evaluate the possibilities. The notes I'd sent with Germain would delay inquiries, and I could put off anyone who did come. But that also meant I could expect no immediate help from the army if help was needed. And it might be. Someone in that hostile crowd on 4th Street might well have heard where I'd told the chairman to come. That hostility now showed itself in a different light. If the rebels in the city were about to rise and turn upon the defenceless loyalists, and the currents I sensed beginning to swirl through the streets were dark ones, someone might just show up on your porch with a keg of tar and a bag of feathers, Jenny observed, preempting my thought in a most unnerving way.
Well, that wouldn't help His Grace's asthma a bit, I said,
and she laughed.
Had you maybe better give him back to General Clinton, she suggested. I've had soldiers search my house. We are wanted man hiding in the bottom of my wardrobe, and my newborn bairn in his arms. I didn't think it would be a great deal easier on the nerves to have the Sons of Liberty come in here after His Grace, if half what Marsali told me about them is true.
It probably is. A gunshot smacked through the heavy air, flat and dull, from somewhere near the river, and we both tensed.
It wasn't repeated, though, and after a moment I drew breath again. The thing is, he's not stable. I can't risk taking him through streets filled with dust and tree pollen, and then leaving him in the care of an army surgeon, or even that quack, Hebdy. Were he to have another attack and no one able to get him through it?
Jenny grimaced. Aye, you're right, she said reluctantly, and you canna leave him here and go yourself, for the same reason.
That's right. And Jamie would be coming here to find me, I thought. I wouldn't leave.
Ken, if Jamie came and didn't find you here, he'd go to the print shop next thing, Jenny observed, making the hair prickle on the back of my neck.
"Will you stop doing that?"
"What?" she said, startled.
"Reading my mind."
"Oh, that." She grinned at me, blue eyes creasing into triangles. "Everything you think shows on your face, Claire. Surely Jamie told you that." A deep flush burned upward from my low-cut décolletage. And only then did I recall that I was still wearing the amber-coloured silk which was now soaked with sweat, rimed with dust, and altogether rather the worse for wear, and which had very tight stays. I rather hoped that everything I was thinking didn't show on my face, because there was quite a bit of information I didn't mean to share with Jenny just yet.
"Well, I canna tell everything you think," she admitted.
"Doing it again, damn it. But it's easy to tell when you're thinking about Jamie." I decided that I really didn't want to hear what I looked like when thinking about Jamie,
and was about to excuse myself to look in on the Duke, who I could hear coughing and swearing breathlessly to himself in German, when my attention was distracted by a boy sprinting down the street as though the devil were after him, his coat on inside out and shirt tails streaming.
"Colenso!" I exclaimed.
"What?" Jenny said, startled.
"Not what, who?"
"Him," I said, pointing at the grubby little creature panting up the walk.
"Colenso Baragwanath, William's groom."
Colenso, who always looked as though he should be squatting atop a toadstool, came hurtling toward the door with such violence that Jenny and I both leapt out of the way. Colenso tripped on the door sill and fell flat on his face.
"You look as though old Horney himself was after you, lad," Jenny said, bending down to wake him to his feet. "And whatever's become of your breeks?"
Sure enough, the boy was barefoot and wearing only his shirt beneath his coat.
"They took them,"
he blurted, gasping for breath.
"Who?"
I said, pulling his coat off and turning it right side out again.
"Them,"
he said, gesturing hopelessly toward Locust Street.
"I put me head into the ordinary to see was Lord Ellesmere there. He is sometimes. And there was a knot of men all buzzing like hive of bees together. They was big lads with them, and one of them as knew me saw me, and raises up a great cry, shouting as I'm a spying on them, and me to take word back to the army. And then they grabbed me, and they called me a turncoat, and put me coat on backward. And the one man said he'd beat me and teach me not to do such as that, and pulled off me breeches and... Anyway, I squirmed out of his hand and fell down on the floor and crawled out under the tables and took off a-running."
He wiped a sleeve under his nose, which was still running.
"Is Lordship here, ma'am?"
"No," I said. "Why do you want him?"
"Oh, I don't, ma'am,"
he assured me with evident sincerity.
"Major Finlay wants him. Now."
Well, wherever he is at the moment, he'll likely go back to his regular billet this evening. You know where that is, don't you?"
"Yes, ma'am. But I'm not a-going back in the street without my breeches."
He looked both horrified and indignant, and Jenny laughed.
"Dinna blame you a bit, lad," she said.
"Tell you what, though, my eldest grandson's likely got an old pair of breeches he could spare. I'll step round to the print shop," she said to me, "fetch the breeches, and tell Marsali what's ado."
"All right," I said, a little reluctant to see her go.
"But hurry back, and tell her not to print any of this in the newspaper."
Chapter 10 The Descent of the Holy Ghost Upon a Reluctant Disciple. Dan Morgan's It was nearby, a ramshackle cabin set in a little elm grove down a short dirt lane off the main road. There was a big grey gelding hobbled and cropping grass nearby, his tack resting on the porch. He looked up briefly and whinnied at the newcomers. Jamie ducked under the lintel after Dan and found himself in a dark, shabby room that smelled of cabbage water, grime, and the sharp reek of urine. There was one window, its shutters left open for air, and the sunlight coming in silhouetted the long skulled head of a large man sitting at the table, who raised his head at the opening of the door.
"Colonel Morgan," he said,
in a soft voice touched with the drawl of Virginia.
"Have you brought me good news?"
"That's just what I brought you, General," old Dan said, and shoved Jamie ahead of him toward the table. "I found this rascal on the road and bade him come along. This'll be Colonel Fraser, who I've told you of before. Just come back from Scotland, and the very man to take command of Taylor's troops."
The big man had risen from the table and put out a hand, smiling, though he smiled with his lips pressed tight together, as though afraid something might escape. The man was as tall as Jamie himself, and Jamie found himself looking straight into sharp grey-blue eyes that took his measure in the instant it took to shake hands.
"George Washington," the man said. "Your servant, sir."
"James Fraser," Jamie said, feeling mildly stunned.
"You're most obedient, sir. Sit with me, Colonel Fraser."
The big Virginian gestured toward one of the rough benches at the table.
My horse pulled up lame, and my slave's gone to find another. No notion how long it may take him, as I require a good sturdy beast to bear my weight, and those are thin on the ground these days.
He looked Jamie up and down with frank appraisal. They were much of a size.
I don't suppose you have a decent horse with you, sir?
Aye, I do.
It was clear what Washington expected, and Jamie yielded gracefully.
Will you do me the honor to take him, General?
Old Dan made a disgruntled noise and shifted from foot to foot, clearly wanting to object. But Jamie gave him a brief shake of the head. It wasn't that far to Philadelphia. He could walk. Washington looked pleased and thanked Jamie with grace in turn, saying that the horse should be returned to him as soon as another suitable mount might be procured.
But it is somewhat necessary that I be nimble at present, Colonel, Washington remarked with an air of apology. You're aware, are you, that Clinton is withdrawing from Philadelphia?
A shock went through Jamie like a hot penny dropped on butter.
No, sir, I was not aware.
I was just about to get to that, Dan said tetchily. No one lets me get one word in edgewise, I tell you.
Well, now you've got one, Washington said, amused. You might get another if you're quick enough to speak before Lee gets here. Sit down, gentlemen, if you will. I'm expecting... Ah, there they are.
Sounds from the dooryard indicated a number of horsemen arriving, and within a few moments the cabin was crowded with Continental officers. They were a creased and weathered lot, for the most part, dressed in motley bits of uniform. These coupled uneasily with hunting shirts or homespun breeches. Even the complete suits of clothes were mud-spattered and worn, and the smell of men who'd been living rough quite overcame the gentler domestic reeks of the cabin. Among the shuffling and excited greetings, Jamie spotted the source of the urinous smell, though. A thin-faced woman stood with her back pressed into a corner of the room, holding an infant wrapped in a ratty shawl against her bosom, her eyes darting to and fro among the intruders. A dark, wet patch showed on the shawl, but it was plain the woman was afraid to move from her place to change the wain, and instead shifted mechanically from foot to foot, patting the child to soothe it.
"Colonel Fraser, well met, well met."
The voice jerked his attention away, and to his astonishment, he found his hand being pumped with enthusiasm by Anthony Wayne, known quite openly by now as Mad Anthony, whom he had last seen a few weeks before the fall of Ticonderoga.
"Is your wife well, sir? And your Indian nephew?"
Wayne was asking, beaming up into Jamie's face. Anthony was short and stocky, with the full cheeks of a chipmunk, but also equipped with a sharp, poking sort of nose, over which his eyes did now and then seem to glow with fire. At the moment, Jamie was relieved to see them merely alight with friendly interest.
"All well, sir, I thank you, and tell me, is your wife near at hand?"
Wayne moved a little closer and lowered his voice a bit.
"I've been having the most damnable time with my gouty foot, and she did wonders with the abscess at the base of my spine while we were at Colonel Fraser, allow me to make you acquainted with Major General Charles Lee and with General Nathaniel Green."
George Washington's voice drove a smooth Virginia wedge between himself and the base of Mad Anthony's spine, to Jamie's relief. Besides Washington himself, Charles Lee was the best equipped of the lot, wearing complete uniform from gorget to polished boots. Jamie hadn't met him before, but could have picked him out of a crowd as a professional soldier, no matter how he was dressed. An Englishman of the sort who seemed always to be smelling something dubious. But he shook hands cordially enough with a clipped, "Your servant, sir." Jamie knew exactly two things about Charles Lee, both told to him by young Ian, to wit, that the man had a Mohawk wife, and that the Mohawk called him Unawaterika. Ian said it meant boiling water. Between Mad Anthony and boiling water, Jamie was beginning to feel that he should have spurred up and run for it when he met Dan Morgan on the road, but too late for regrets.
Sit, gentlemen, we have no time to waste.
Washington turned to the woman in the corner.
Have you anything to drink, Mrs. Hardman?
Jamie saw her throat move as she swallowed, squeezing the child so hard that it squealed like a piglet and started to cry. He felt several of the men, doubtless fathers, wince at the sound. No friend, she said, and he realized she was a Quaker. Naught but water from the well. Shall I fetch you a bucket?
Don't trouble thyself, friend Hardman, Nathaniel Green said soft-voiced. I've two bottles in my saddlebag will do us.
He moved slowly toward the woman, not to startle her, and took her gently by the arm.
Come outside. Thee needn't be disturbed by this business.
He was a heavy, imposing man who walked with a noticeable limp, but she seemed reassured by his plain speech, and went with him, though looking back with an anxious face as though fearing that the men might set fire to the place. A quarter hour later, Jamie wasn't so sure that they might not ignite the cabin by the sheer force of their excitement. Washington and his troops had been bottled up at Valley Forge for the last 6 months, drilling and preparing, and the generals were on fire to be at the enemy. Much talk, plans proposed, argued over, put aside, returned to. Jamie listened with half a mind. The other half was in Philadelphia. He'd heard enough from Fergus to know that the city was divided, with regular clashes between patriots and loyalists. These kept under control only by the presence of the British soldiers. But the loyalists were a minority. The moment the army's protection was withdrawn, the loyalists would be at the mercy of the rebels. And rebels who had been suppressed for months were not likely to be merciful. And Claire. His mouth went dry. Claire was, so far as anyone in Philadelphia knew, the wife of Lord John Grey, a very visible loyalist. And Jamie himself had just removed John Grey's protection from her, leaving her alone and helpless in a city about to explode. How long did he have before the British left the city? No one at the table knew. He took as little part as possible in the conversation, both because he was estimating how fast he could reach Philadelphia on foot, versus the possibility of going out to the privy and stealing back the horse he'd just given Washington, and because he hadn't forgotten what old Dan had said to General Washington when he'd dragged Jamie in here. The very last thing he wanted was... And you, Colonel Fraser, Washington said. Jamie closed his eyes and commended his soul to God.
Will you do me the signal service of accepting command of Henry Taylor's battalion? General Taylor fell ill and died 2 days ago.
I am honored, sir, Jamie managed, thinking frantically. But I have very urgent business in Philadelphia. I should be happy to oblige you so soon as my business is accomplished. And I could, of course, bring back word of exactly how matters stand with General Clinton's forces.
Washington had been looking severe during the first part of this speech, but the last sentence made Green and Morgan hum with approval, and Wayne nod his little chipmunk head.
Can you manage your business within 3 days, Colonel?
Yes, sir.
It was no more than 10 miles to the city. He could do that in 2 or 3 hours. And it wasn't going to take him more than 30 seconds to take Claire out of that house once he reached it. Very well, then. You're appointed to a temporary field rank of Lieutenant General that...
Ethan.
I beg your pardon, Colonel.
Washington looked puzzled. Dan Morgan, who'd heard Jamie say hell in Gaelic before, shook silently beside him.
I thank you, sir.
He swallowed, feeling a dizzy wave of heat pass over him.
Though the Congress will have to approve your appointment, Washington went on, frowning a little. And there's no guarantee as to what those contentious shopkeeping sons of bitches will do.
I understand, sir. Jamie assured him.
He could only hope. Dan Morgan passed him a bottle, and he drank deep, hardly noticing what was in it. Sweating profusely, he sank back on the bench, hoping to avoid any further notice.
Jesus, now what?
He'd meant to slip quietly into the city and out again with Claire, then head south to retrieve his printing press, perhaps establish a wee business in Charleston or Savannah until the war was over, and they could go home to the Ridge. But he had known there was a risk. Any man below the age of 60 could be compelled into militia service, and if it came down to it, he was likely a little safer being a general than a commander of militia. Maybe. And a general could resign. That was a heartening thought. Despite all the talk and the worrying prospects of the immediate future, Jamie found himself paying more attention to Washington's face than to what he said, taking note of how the man talked and carried himself, so that he could tell Claire. He wished that he could tell Brianna. She and Roger Mack had sometimes speculated about what it might be like to meet someone like Washington. Though, having met a number of famous people himself, he told her that the experience was likely to prove a disappointment. He would admit that Washington knew what he was about, though. He listened more than he talked. And when he said something, it was to the point. And he did give off an air of relaxed authority, though it was clear the present prospect excited him very much. His face was pockmarked, big-featured, and far from handsome, but had a good bit of dignity and presence. His expression had become very animated, and he went so far as to laugh now and then, showing very bad stained teeth. Jamie was fascinated. Brianna had told him they were false, made of wood or hippopotamus ivory, and he had a sudden dislocating recollection of his grandfather. The old fox had had a set of teeth made of beechwood. Jamie had thrown them on the fire during an argument at Beaufort Castle. And just for an instant, he was there, smelling peat smoke and roasting venison, every hair on his body a prickle with warning, surrounded by kinsmen who might just kill him. And as suddenly he was back, pressed between Lee and old Dan, smelling sweat and exhilaration, and despite himself, feeling the rising excitement among them begin to seep into his blood. It gave him a queer feeling in his wame to sit nearly more than a foot away from a man whom he knew not at all, but about whom he maybe kent more than the man himself. True, he'd sat with Charles Stuart many evenings, knowing and believing what Claire had said would happen to him. But still, Christ had told doubting Thomas, "Blessed are those who have not seen, but have believed." Jamie wondered what you called those who had seen and were obliged to live with the resultant knowledge. He thought blessed was maybe not the word. It was more than an hour before Washington and the others took their leave, an hour during which Jamie thought repeatedly that he might just stand up, flip the table over, and run out the door, leaving the Continental Army to make shift without him. He kent perfectly well that armies moved slowly, save when fighting, and clearly Washington expected that it would be a week or more before the British actually quit Philadelphia. But it was no use talking sense to his body, which, as usual, had its own measures of importance. He could ignore or suppress hunger, thirst, fatigue, and injury. He couldn't suppress the need to see Claire. Likely it was what she and Brianna called testosterone poisoning, he thought idly, their term for the obvious things men did that women didn't understand. Someday he must ask her what testosterone was. He shifted uncomfortably on the narrow bench, forcing his mind back to what Washington was saying. At long last there came a rap on the door, and a black man put his head in and nodded to Washington.
"Ready, sir,"
he said, in the same soft Virginia accent as his master.
"Thank you, Caesar."
Washington nodded back, then put his hands on the table and rose swiftly.
"We are agreed, then, gentlemen. You're coming with me, General Lee. I'll see the rest of you in due course at Sutphin's farm, save you here otherwise."
Jamie's heart leapt, and he made to rise too, but old Dan put a hand on his sleeve.
"Said a bit, Jamie," he said. "You'll need to know something about your new command, won't you?"
"I, he began. but there was no help for it. He sat and waited while Nathaniel Green thanked Mrs. Hardman for her hospitality and begged her to accept a small recompense from the army for her civil reception of them. Jamie would have wagered a good deal that the coins he plucked from his purse were his own, and not the army's. But the woman took them, an acceptance too faint to be pleasure showing in her worn face. He saw her shoulders sag with relief as the door closed behind the general's, and realized that their presence might have put her and her child in considerable peril should the wrong people see uniformed Continental officers visiting her house. She glanced consideringly at him and Dan, but they seemed to trouble her much less in their rough civilian clothes. Dan had taken off his uniform coat, folded it inside out, and laid it on the bench beside him.
"Feel any tongues of fire come down on your head just now, Jamie?"
Dan asked, seeing his look.
"What?" "Then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, came Jesus, and stood in the midst, and saith unto them, 'Peace be unto you,'"
Dan quoted, and grinned wide at Jamie's look of astonishment.
"My Abigail's a reading woman, and she reads bits of the Bible out to me regular in hopes it'll do some good. Though ain't much luck in that direction yet."
He took up the rucksack he'd brought in and dredged about in it, coming out with a folded sheaf of dog-eared papers, an inkhorn, and a couple of tattered quills.
"Well, now that the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost are gone off about their own business, let me write you down the names of your company commanders, what all you got in the way of militia, and where they all are, 'cause it ain't like they're all in barracks or even in the same village. Mrs. Hardman, might I trouble you, ma'am, for a drop of water for my ink?"
Jamie bent his mind with difficulty to the business at hand, the better to dispatch it quickly, and within a quarter hour was gathering together the lists made out in Dan's slow, crabbed hand.
2 hours to Philadelphia, maybe three.
"Got any money on you to speak of?" Dan asked, pausing by the door.
"Not a penny,"
Jamie admitted, with a glance at the spot on his belt where his purse was normally fastened. He'd given it to Jenny to keep on the journey, as she delighted in making their small purchases. And this morning he'd been so much on fire to see Claire that he'd left the print shop with nothing but the clothes on his back and the packet of papers for Fergus. He spared an instant to wonder whether things would be different now, had he not been spotted giving the papers to Fergus and followed to Lord John's house by the soldiers and William. But there was no point in regrets. Dan poured in his sack again, came out with a smaller bag and a clinking purse, both of which he tossed to Jamie.
"Bit of food for your journey and an advance on your general's pay," he said,
and chortled with amusement at his own wit.
"You'll need to pay hard cash for a uniform these days. Ain't a tailor in Philadelphia will take Continentals. And woe betide you if you show up before his worshipfulness George Washington without being dressed proper. He's a stickler for proper uniform, because you can't expect to command respect without looking like you deserve it. But I reckon you know all about that."
Dan, who had fought both battles of Saratoga in a hunting shirt, leaving his uniform coat hung over a tree branch in camp because of the heat, smiled broadly at Jamie, the scar on his upper lip where a bullet had torn through his face, showing white against the weathered skin.
"Fare thee well, General Fraser."
Jamie snorted, but smiled nonetheless as he stood to shake Dan's hand. Then he turned back to the litter on the table, stowing the papers and purse, and a stray quill that Dan had abandoned, overlooked, into the bag. He was grateful for the food. The scent of jerked meat and johnny cake floated out of the canvas depths, and he could feel the hard shape of apples at the bottom. He'd left the print shop without breakfast, too. He straightened, and a pain like white lightning shot from the middle of his spine down the back of his leg to the sole of his foot. He gasped and collapsed onto a stool, his lower back and right buttock clenched with cramp.
"Jesus, Mary and Bride, not now,"
he said between his teeth. and meant it somewhere between prayer and curse. He'd felt something small wrench or tear in his back when he'd hit John Gray, but in the heat of the moment it hadn't seemed important. It hadn't troubled him much walking. He'd barely noticed, was all there was on his mind. But now that he'd sat for a time, and the muscles had chilled. He tried rising, carefully, collapsed again. Bent sweating over the table with his fists clenched, he said a number of things in Gaelic that weren't at all prayerful.
"Is he quite well, friend?" The woman of the house leaned near, peering near-sightedly at him in concern.
A moment, he managed, trying to do as Claire told him and breathe through the spasms.
Like labour pains, she'd told him, amused. He hadn't thought it was funny the first time, and didn't now. The pain eased. He extended his leg, then flexed it back under him, very gingerly. So far, so good. But when he once more tried to rise, his lower back was locked in a vice, and a pain that made him catch his breath stabbed down his buttock.
"Have you anything like whiskey? Rum?"
If he could just get to his feet. But the woman was shaking her head.
"I'm sorry, friend. I have not even small beer. Not even milk for the children any longer," she added with a certain bitterness. "The army took my goats away."
She didn't say which army, but he supposed it didn't matter to her. He made a sound of apology just in case it had been the Continentals or the militia, and subsided, breathing heavily. This has happened 3 times before. Just the same sudden flashing pain, the inability to move. Once it had taken 4 days before he could hobble. The other 2 times he had got to his feet within 2 days, and while it had twinged sporadically for weeks, he'd been able to walk, if slowly.
"Is thee ill? I could give thee rhubarb syrup," she offered.
He managed to smile at that, shaking his head.
"I thank you, ma'am. It's no but a clench in my back. When it eases, all will be well."
The trouble was that until it eased, he was all but helpless, and the dawning realization of that gave him a sense of panic.
"Oh."
The woman hesitated for a moment, hovering, but then the baby started to wail, and she turned away to fetch it. A little girl, 5 or 6, he thought, a stunted little creature, crawled out from under the bed and stared at him curiously.
"Is he going to stay to supper?"
she asked, in a high, precise voice. She gave him an appraising frown.
"Thee looks like thee would eat a lot."
He revised his estimate of the girl's age to 8 or 9 and smiled at her. He was still sweating with the pain, but it was easing a bit.
"I'll not take your food, Anian," he assured her. "In fact, there's a good loaf and some jerked meat in yon bag. It's yours."
Her eyes went round as pennies, and he amended,
"Your family's, I mean."
She glanced eagerly at the bag, swallowing painfully as her mouth watered. He could hear the tiny gulp, and it wrung his heart.
"Prue,"
she whispered, turning urgently toward the table.
"Food."
Another small girl crawled out and stood beside her sister. They were both plain as fence posts, though they otherwise didn't resemble each other much.
"I heard,"
the newcomer told her sister, and turned a solemn gaze on Jamie.
"Don't let Mam give thee rhubarb syrup," she advised him. "It makes thee shit like the blazes, and if thee can't get to the privy, it—"
"Prudence!" Prudence obligingly shut her mouth, though she continued to look Jamie over with interest. Her sister knelt and rummaged under the bed, emerging with the family utensil. This, a homely object of brown earthenware, which he presented gravely for his inspection.
"We'll turn our back, sir, if thee should need to—"
"Patience!" Red in the face, Mrs. Hardman took the piss-pot from her daughter and shooed the little girls to the table, where, with a glance at Jamie to be sure he had meant it, she took the bread and meat and apples from his bag, dividing the food scrupulously into 3 parts, 2 large portions for the girls and a small one for herself, put aside for later. She had left the chamber-pot on the floor beside the bed and as she eased him gingerly onto the corn-shuck mattress, Jamie caught sight of lettering painted in white across the bottom. He squinted to make it out in the dim light, then smiled. It was a Latin motto, encircling a vividly executed B with a jovial expression, and a pronounced wink. Iam apis potanda fineo ne. He'd seen the jest before. The brothel in Edinburgh, where he'd once kept a room, had been equipped throughout with utensils sporting a variety of Latin tags, most of them prurient, but some merely puns, like this one. It was a Latin sentence, if a foolish one. Drink not the bee now. But if read phonetically in English, ignoring the spacing, it read, I am a pisspot, and a fine one. He glanced up at Mrs. Hardman in speculation, but thought it was likely not her work. The absent Mr. Hardman must be, or have been, he thought, given the obvious poverty of the household, and he crossed himself unobtrusively at the thought, an educated man. The baby had waked, and was fussing in her cradle, making small sharp yelps like a fox kit. Mrs. Hardman scooped the child out, pulling a worn nursing chair toward the fire with one foot. She laid the baby momentarily on the bed beside Jamie, opening her blouse with one hand, the other reaching automatically to save an apple that was rolling toward the edge of the table, nudged by a little girl's elbow. The baby smacked her lips, hungry as her sister's.
"And this will be wee chastity, I make nae doot," he said.
Mrs. Hardman gaped at him.
"How did thee know the child's name?"
He glanced at Prudence and Patience, who were silently stuffing bread and meat into their mouths as quickly as they could eat.
"Well, I havena yet met a lassie named Sobriety or Fortitude," he said mildly. "The wain's sopping. Have you a clean clootie for her?"
There were two worn clouts hung to dry before the fire. She brought one to find that Jamie had already unpinned the baby's soggy nappy, that's what Claire called them, and wiped the shit from her bottom, holding her tiny ankles in one hand.
"Thee has children, I see."
Eyebrows raised, Mrs. Hardman took the soiled clout from him with a nod of thanks, and dropped it into a bucket of vinegar and water that stood in the far corner.
"And grandchildren," he said,
wiggling a finger in front of wee Chastity's nose. She gurgled and went cross-eyed, kicking her legs enthusiastically.
"To say nothing of six nephews and nieces."
"And where are Jem and wee Mandy, I wonder? Can she breathe easy now, poor lassie?"
He gently tickled the baby's soft pink foot, remembering the strangely beautiful, heart-wrenching blue tinge to Mandy's perfect toes, long-jointed and graceful as a frog's. "They're just like yours," Claire had told him, drawing a fingernail lightly down the sole of Mandy's foot, making the long, big toe spring suddenly away from the others.
What had she called that?
He tried it himself gingerly, and smiled with delight to see it happen to Chastity's chubby toes.
"Babinski," he said to Mrs. Hardman,
with a sense of deep satisfaction at recalling the name.
"That's what it's called when a wain's great toe does that. A Babinski reflex."
Mrs. Hardman looked astonished, though much more so when he skilfully repinned the new clout and swaddled wee Chastity afresh in her blanket. She took the baby from him, and with an uncertain expression, sank down in the chair and pulled the ratty shawl over the baby's head. Unable to turn over easily, Jamie instead closed his eyes to afford her such privacy as he could. Chapter 11. Remember Paoli. It was hard to wipe away the sweat with his hands tied,